well be the earliest documented case of stomach reduction, one enterprising son presented his father with lard of left waist. Though the list format is easy on the eyes, there are instances where one aches for more information. Did the young girl who gave her mother-in-law her left eyeball do so to prove the depth of her devotion or to horrify and spite the woman? Examples for the Ming Dynasty were so numerous that Chang gave up on listing individual instances and presented them instead as tallies by category. In total, some 286 pieces of thigh, 37 pieces of arm, 24 livers, 13 unspecified cuts of flesh, 4 fingers, 2 ears, 2 broiled breasts, 2 ribs, 1 waist loin, 1 knee, and 1 stomach skin were fed to sickly elders. Interestingly, Li Shichen disapproved of the practice. Li Shichen acknowledged these practices among the ignorant masses, wrote Reed, but he did not consider that any parent, however ill, should expect such sacrifices from their children. Modern Chinese no doubt agree with him, though reports of the practice occasionally crop up. Chang cites a Taiwan news story from May 1987 in which a daughter cut off a piece of her thigh to cook up a cure for her ailing mother. Although Chang writes in his book that even today, in the People's Republic of China, the use of human fingers, toes, nails, dried urine, feces, and breast milk are strongly recommended by the government to cure certain diseases. He cites the 1977 Cheng Yao Ta Tzu Tian, the Great Dictionary of Chinese Pharmacology. He could not put me in touch with anyone who actually partakes, and I more or less abandoned my search. Then, several weeks later, an email arrived from him. It contained a story from the Japan Times that week entitled, 3 Million Chinese Drink Urine. Around that same time, I happened upon a story on the Internet, originally published in the London Daily Telegraph, which based its story on one from the day before in the now-defunct Hong Kong Eastern Express. The article stated that private and state-run clinics and hospitals in Shenzhen, outside Hong Kong, sold or gave away aborted fetuses as a treatment for skin problems and asthma, and as a general health tonic. "There are 10 fetuses here, all aborted this morning," the Express reporter claimed she was told while visiting the Shenzhen Health Center for Women and Children undercover and asking for fetuses. "Normally, we doctors take them home to eat. Since you don't look well, you can take them." The article bordered on the farcical. It had hospital cleaning women, quote, fighting each other to take the treasured human remains home. Sleazy, unnamed chaps in Hong Kong back alleys charging $300 per fetus, and a sheepish businessman, quote, introduced to fetuses by friends, furtively making his way to Shenzhen with his thermos flask every couple of weeks to bring back 20 or 30 at a time for his asthma. In both this instance and that of the 3 million urine-quaffing Chinese, I don't know whether the reports were true, partially true, or instances of bald-faced Chinese bashing. Aiming to find out, I contacted Sandy Wan, a Chinese interpreter and researcher who had done work for me before in China. As it turned out, Sandy used to live in Shenzhen, had heard of the clinics mentioned in the article, and still had friends there. Friends who were willing to pose, bless their hearts, as fetus-seeking patients. Her friends, a Miss Wu and a Mr. Guy, started out at the private clinics, saying they'd heard it was possible to buy fetuses for medicinal purposes. Both got the same answer. It used to be possible, but the government of Shenzhen had some time ago declared it illegal to sell both fetuses and placentas. The two were told that the materials were collected by a health care production company with a unified management. It soon became clear what that meant and what was being done with the materials. At the state-run Shenzhen People's Hospital, the region's largest, Ms. Wu went to the Chinese medicine department to ask a doctor for treatment for the blemishes on her face. The doctor recommended a medication called Tai Bao capsules, which were sold in the hospital dispensary for about $2.50 a bottle. When Miss Wu asked what the medication was, the doctor replied that it was made from abortus, as it was called there, and placenta, and that it was very good for the skin. Meanwhile, over in the internal medicine department, Mr. Guy had claimed to have asthma and told the doctor that his friends had recommended abortus. The doctor said he hadn't heard of selling fetuses to patients directly and that they were taken away by a company controlled by the Board of Health, which was authorized to make them into capsules, the Tai Bao capsules that had been prescribed to Miss Wu. Sandy read the Express article to a friend who works as a doctor in Haikou, where the two women live. While her friend felt that the article was exaggerated, she also felt that fetal tissue did have health benefits and approved of making use of it. "It is a pity," she said, "to throw them away with other rubbish." Sandy herself, a Christian, finds the practice immoral. It seems to me that the Chinese, relative to Americans, have a vastly more practical, less emotional outlook when it comes to what people put in their mouths. Tai Bao capsules notwithstanding, I'm with the Chinese. The fact that Americans love dogs doesn't make it immoral for the Chinese of Pejian City, who apparently don't love dogs, to wrap dog meat in pita bread and eat it for breakfast, just as the Hindus' reverence for cows doesn't make it wrong for us to make them into belts and meatloaves. We are all products of our upbringing, our culture, our need to conform. There are those, okay, one person, who feel that cannibalism has its place in a strictly rational society. When a man evolves a civilization higher than the mechanized but still primitive one he has now, wrote Diego Rivera in his memoir, the eating of human flesh will be sanctioned. For then man will have thrown off all of his superstitions and irrational taboos. Of course, the issue of taking fetus pills is complicated by the involvement and rights of the mother. If a hospital wants to sell or even give away women's aborted fetuses to make them into pills, they owe it to those women to ask for their consent. To do elsewise is callous and disrespectful. Any attempt to market Tai Bao capsules in the United States would be disastrous, owing to conservative religious views about the status of all fetuses as full-fledged human beings with all the rights and powers accorded their more cellularly differentiated brethren, and to good old-fashioned American squeamishness. The Chinese are simply not a squeamish people. Sandy once told me about a famous Chinese recipe called Scream Three Times, in which newborn mice are taken from their mothers, the first scream, dropped in a hot fry pan, second scream, and eaten, third scream. Then again, we drop live lobsters into boiling water and rid our homes of mice by gluing down their feet and letting them starve, so let us not rush to cast the first stone. I began to wonder, would any culture go so far as to use human flesh as food simply out of practicality? China has a long and vivid history of cannibalism, but I'm not convinced that the taboo against it is any weaker there than elsewhere. Of the thousands of instances of cannibalism throughout China's history, the vast majority of the perpetrators were driven to the act either by starvation or the desire to express hatred or exact revenge during war. Indeed, without a strong cannibalism taboo, the eating of one's enemy's heart or liver would not have been the act of psychological brutality that it clearly was. Kirei Chong managed to unearth only 10 cases of what he calls taste cannibalism, eating the flesh or organs of the dead not because you have nothing else to eat or you despise your enemy or you're trying to cure an ailing parent, but simply because it's tasty and a pity to waste it. He writes that in years past, another job perk of the Chinese executioner, in addition to supplemental income from human blood and fat sales, was that he was allowed to take the heart and brains home for supper. In modern times, human meat for private consumption tends to come from murder victims, cannibalism providing at once a memorable repast and a handy means of disposing of the body. Chong relates the tale of a couple in Beijing who killed a teenager, cooked his flesh, and shared it with the neighbors, telling them it was camel meat. According to the story, which ran in the Chinese Daily News on April 8, 1985, the couple confessed that their motive had been a strong craving for human flesh, developed during wartime when food was scarce. Chong doesn't find the story far-fetched. Because starvation cannibalism was widespread in the country's history, he believes that some Chinese in certain hard-hit regions over time may have developed a taste for human flesh. It is said to be quite good. The Colorado prospector, Alfred Packer, who after his provisions ran out began lunching on the five companions he was later accused of killing, told a reporter in 1883 that the breasts of men were the sweetest meat he'd ever tasted. A sailor on the damaged and drifting schooner, Sally M. Steelman, in 1878, described the flesh of one of the dead crewmen as being as good as any beefsteak he ever ate. Rivera, if we are to believe his anatomy lab tale, considered the legs, breasts, and breaded ribs of the female cadavers delicacies, and especially relished women's brains in vinaigrette. Despite Chong's theory about Chinese peoples occasionally acquiring a taste for human meat, and despite China's natural culinary inhibition, instances of modern-day taste cannibalism are hard to find, and even harder to verify. According to a 1991 Reuters article, diners loved human flesh dumplings. A man who worked in a crematorium in Hainan province was caught hacking the buttocks and thighs off cadavers prior to incineration and bringing the meat to his brother, who ran the nearby White Temple restaurant. For 3 years, the story went, Wang Gong was doing a brisk business in Sichuan-style dumplings made with flesh from the nether regions of his brother Hui's customers. The brothers were caught when the parents of a young woman killed in a road accident wanted to have a last look at her before cremation. On discovering that her buttocks had been removed, wrote the reporter, they called the police. A second Reuters story on cannibalistic crematorium workers cropped up on May 6, 2002. The article detailed the escapades of two Phnom Penh men accused, but not prosecuted, for there was no law against cannibalism, of eating human fingers and toes, washed down with wine. The story smacked of urban myth. Sandy Wan told me she'd heard a similar story about a Chinese restaurant owner who sees an accident and rushes over to slice off the buttocks of the dead driver to use them as filling in steamed meat buns. And the Hainan Reuters article had questionable elements. How would the parents have seen their daughter's buttocks? Presumably she was on her back in a coffin when they brought her out for a final viewing. And why would the original article from the Hainan Special Zone Daily supply the names of the men but not their town? Then again, this was Reuters. They don't make things up, do they? Supper on China South Airways was an unsliced hamburger bun and a puckered, unadorned wiener rolled loose in a pressed aluminum container. The wiener was too small for the bun, too small for any bun, too small for its own skin. Even for airline food, the meal was repugnant. The flight attendant, having handed out the last of the meals, immediately about-faced, returned to the front of the plane and began picking them up and dropping them into a garbage bag, on the just and accurate assumption that no one was going to eat them. If the White Temple restaurant still existed, I would be able to order an equally off-putting meal in about an hour. The plane was landing shortly on Hainan Island, alleged home of the Buttock Boys. I had been in Hong Kong and decided to hop over to Hainan to look into the story. Hainan province turns out to be relatively small. It's an island off China's southwest coast. The island has only one large city, Haikou. And Haikou, I found out by emailing the webmaster of the official Hainan Window website and pretending to be a funeral professional, a journalistic inquiry had gone unanswered, has a crematorium. If the story was true, this had to be where it happened. I would go to the crematorium and try to track down Hui and Wang Gong. I would ask them about their motives. Were they cheap and greedy, or were they simply practical? Two well-meaning fellows who hated to see good meat go to waste. Did they see no wrong in their actions? Did they themselves eat and enjoy the dumplings? Did they think all human cadavers should be recycled this way? My communications with the Hainan webmaster had led me to believe that Haikou was a small, compact city, almost more of a town, and that most people spoke some English. The webman did not have the address of the crematorium, but thought I could find it by asking around. Even just ask a taxi driver, he wrote. It took a half hour to even just ask a taxi driver to take me to my hotel. Like all taxi drivers, and almost everyone else in Haikou, he spoke no English. Why should he? Few foreigners come to Hainan, only holiday-making Chinese from the mainland. The driver eventually telephoned a friend who spoke some English, and I found myself in the midst of a vast urban sprawl in a modern high-rise with huge red Chinese characters on its roof spelling out, I supposed, the hotel's name. Chinese big-city hotel rooms are modeled after their Western counterparts, with triangulated toilet paper ends and complimentary shower caps. However, there is always something slightly, ever so charmingly off. Here it was a tiny bottle labeled shampoo, and a flyer offering the services of a blind masseuse. "Oh, ma'am, I'm so sorry. I thought that was your back. You see, I'm blind." Exhausted, I collapsed on the bed, which made a shrieking, assaulted noise, suggesting that it could as easily have been the bed that collapsed on me. In the morning, I approached the reception desk. One of the girls spoke a little English, which was helpful, though she had an unsettling habit of saying, "Are you okay?" in place of, "How are you?" as though I'd tripped on the rug coming out of the elevator. She understood taxi and pointed to one outside. The night before, in preparation for my journey, I had drawn a picture to give to the cab driver. It showed a body hovering above flames, and to the right of this I drew an urn, though the latter had come out looking like a samovar, and there was a distinct possibility that the driver would think I was looking for a place to get Mongolian barbecue. The driver looked at the piece of paper, seemed to understand, and pulled out into traffic. We drove for a long time, and it seemed we might actually be headed for the outskirts of town, where the crematorium was said to be. And then I saw my hotel go by on the right. We were driving in circles. What was going on? Did the blind masseuse moonlight as a cab driver? This was not good. I was not okay. I motioned to my merrily revolving driver to pull over, and I pointed to the Chinese tourism agency office on the map. Eventually, the taxi pulled up outside a brightly lit fried chicken establishment, the sort of place that in the United States might proclaim, "We do chicken right," but here proclaimed, "Do me chicken." The cab driver turned to collect his fare. We shouted at each other for a while, and eventually he got out and walked over to a tiny, dim storefront next to the chicken place and pointed vigorously to a sign. "Designated Foreign-Oriented Tourist Unit," it said. "Well, do me chicken." The man was right. Inside, the tourist unit was having a cigarette break, which, judging from the density of the smoke, had been going on for some time, years possibly. The walls were bare cement, and part of the ceiling was falling in. There were no travel brochures or train timetables, only a map of the world and a small wall-mounted shrine with a red electric candle and a bowl of offerings. The gods were having apples. In the back of the office, I could see two brand-new shrink-wrapped chairs. This struck me as an odd purchasing decision, what with the ceiling collapsing and the very slim likelihood that more than two or three tourists a year came in and needed a place to sit. I explained to the woman that I wanted to hire an interpreter. Miraculously, two phone calls and half an hour later, one appeared. It was Sandy Wan, the woman who would later help me track down the truth about the abortus vendors. I explained that I needed to talk to someone at the Haikou Crematorium. Sandy's English vocabulary was impressive, but, understandably, did not include crematorium. I described it as the big building where they burn dead bodies. She didn't catch the last bit and thought I meant some sort of factory. "What kind of material?" she asked. The entire staff of the designated foreign-oriented tourist unit were looking on, trying to follow the conversation. "Dead people material," I smiled helplessly. "Dead bodies." "Ah," said Sandy. She did not flinch. She explained to the tourist unit, who nodded as though they got this sort of thing all the time. Then she asked me for the address. When I replied that I didn't know it, she got the crematorium phone number from the information operator, called the place to get the address, and even set up an appointment with the director. She was amazing. I couldn't imagine what she had told the man or what she thought I needed to talk to him about. I began to feel a little sorry for the crematorium director, thinking he was about to be visited by a grieving foreign widow, or perhaps some glad-handing retort salesman there to help him cut costs and maximize efficiency. In the cab, I tried to think of a way to explain to Sandy what I was about to have her do. "I need you to ask this man whether he had an employee who cut the butt cheeks off cadavers to serve in his brother's restaurant." No matter how I thought of phrasing it, it sounded ghastly and absurd. Why would I need to know this? What kind of book was I writing? Fearing that Sandy might change her mind, I said nothing about the dumplings. I said that I was writing an article for a funeral industry magazine. We were outside the city proper now. Trucks and scooters had gone scarce. People drove wooden ox carts and wore the round, peaked sun hats you see in rural Vietnam, only these were fashioned from laminated newspaper. I wondered if someone, somewhere, was wearing the March 23, 1991 edition of the Hainan Special Zone Daily. The taxi turned off onto a dirt road. We passed a brick smokestack, issuing clouds of black. The crematorium. Farther down the road was the accompanying funeral home and the crematorium offices. We were directed up a broad marble stairway to the director's office. This could only go poorly. The Chinese are wary of reporters, especially foreign ones, and very especially foreign ones suggesting that your staff mutilated the dead relatives of paying customers to make dumplings. What had I been thinking? The director's office was large and sparsely furnished. There was nothing on the walls but a clock, as if no one knew how to decorate for death. Sandy and I were seated in leather chairs that sat low to the floor like car seats and told that the director would be in to see us shortly. Sandy smiled at me, unaware of the horror about to unfold. "Sandy," I blurted out, "I have to tell you what this is about. There was this guy who cut the butts off dead bodies to give to his brother to..." It was at that moment that the director walked in. The director was a stern-looking Chinese woman, easily 6 feet tall. From my humbled position near the floor, she seemed to be of superhuman proportions, as tall as the smokestack outside and as likely to belch forth smoke. The director sat down at her desk. She looked at me. Sandy looked at me. Feeling seasick, I launched into my story. Sandy listened, and bless her, betrayed no emotion. She turned to the director, who was not smiling, had not smiled since she entered the room, had possibly never smiled, and she told her what I had just said. She relayed the story of Hui Gong, explained that I thought he might have been employed here, and that I wrote for a magazine, and that I hoped to find him and speak to him. The director crossed her arms, and her eyes narrowed. I thought I saw her nostrils flare. Her reply went on for 10 minutes. Sandy nodded politely through it all, with the attentive calm of a person being given a fast food order or directions to the mall. I was very impressed. Then she turned to me. "The director, she is, very angry. The director is very astonished to have these facts. She never heard of this story. She says she has known all her workers, and she has been here for more than 10 years, and she would know about this kind of story. Also, she feels it is a really sick story, and so she cannot help you." I would love to see a full transcript of the director's reply, and then again I wouldn't. Back in the cab, I explained myself to Sandy as best I could. I apologized for putting her through this. She laughed. We both laughed. We laughed so hard that the cab driver demanded to know what we were laughing about, and he laughed too. The cab driver had grown up in Haikou, and he hadn't heard the story of the Gong brothers. Neither, it later turned out, had any of Sandy's friends. We had the driver let us off at the Haikou Public Library to look for the original article. As it turns out, no paper named the Hainan Special Zone Daily exists, only the Hainan Special Zone Times, which is a weekly. Sandy looked through the papers for the weeks of March 23, 1991, but there was no mention of the human dumplings. She also checked old phone books for the White Temple restaurant and found nothing. There wasn't much more to do in Haikou, so I took the bus south to Sanya, where the beaches are beautiful and the weather is fine, and there is, I found out, another crematorium. Sandy called the director and received a similarly indignant reply. On the beach that afternoon, I spread my towel a few feet away from a wooden sign that advised beachgoers, "Do not spit at the beach." Unless, I thought to myself, the beach suffers from nightmares, ulcers, ophthalmia, or fetid perspiration. Anthropologists will tell you that the reason people never dined regularly on other people is economics. While there existed, I am told, cultures in Central America that actually ranched humans, kept enemy soldiers captive for a while to fatten them up, it was not practical to do so, because you had to give up more food to feed them than you'd gain in the end by eating them. Carnivores and omnivores, in other words, make lousy livestock. Humans are very inefficient in converting calories into body composition, said Stanley Garn, a retired anthropologist with the Center for Human Growth and Development at the University of Michigan. I'd called him because he wrote an American anthropologist paper on the topic of human flesh and its nutritional value. "Your cows," he said, "are much more efficient." but I am not so much interested in cultures eating the flesh of their captive enemies as I am in cultures eating their own dead, the practical why-not model of cannibalism, eating the meat of fresh corpses because it's there and it's a nice change from taro root. If you're not going out and capturing people and or going to the trouble of fattening them up, then the nutritional economics begin to make more sense. I found an American Anthropologist article, a reply to Garn stating that there are in fact instances of groups of humans who will eat not only enemies they have killed, but members of their own group who have died of natural causes. Though in every case, the author, University of California, San Diego, anthropologist Stanley Wallens, said the cannibalism was couched in ritual. No culture, as far as he knew, simply carved up dead tribe members to distribute as meat. Garn seemed to disagree. Lots of cultures ate their dead, he said, though I couldn't get any specifics out of him. He added that many groups, too many, he said, to specify, would eat infants as a means of population control when food was scarce. Did they kill them, or were they already dead, I wanted to know. Well, he replied, they were dead by the time they ate them. This is how conversations with Stanley Garn seemed to go. Somehow, midway through our chat, he steered the conversation from nutritional cannibalism to the history of landfill, a pretty sharp turn, and there it more or less remained. You should write a book about that, he said, and I think he meant it. I had called Stanley Garn because I was looking for an anthropologist who had done a nutritional analysis of human flesh and or organ meats. Just, you know, curious. Garn hadn't exactly done this, but he had worked out the lean fat percentage of human flesh. He estimates that humans have more or less the same body composition as veal. To arrive at the figure, Garn extrapolated from average human body fat percentages. There's information of that sort on people in most countries now, he said, so you can see who you want for dinner. I wondered how far the beef-human analogy carried. Was it true of human flesh as of beef that a cut with more fat is considered more flavorful? Yep, said Garn. And as with livestock, the better nourished the individuals, the higher the protein content. The little people of the world, said Garn, and I had to assume he was referring to the malnourished denizens of the third world and not dwarfs, are hardly worth eating. To my knowledge, there is only one group of individuals today whose daily diet may contain significant amounts of their own dead, and that is the California canine. In 1989, while researching a story on a ridiculous and racist law aimed at preventing Asian immigrants from eating their neighbor's dogs, which was already illegal because it's illegal to steal a dog, I learned that, owing to California Clean Air Act regulations, humane societies had switched from cremating euthanized pets to what one official called the rendering situation. I called up a rendering plant to learn into what the dogs were being rendered. We grind them up and turn them into bone meal, the plant manager had said. Bone meal is a common ingredient in fertilizers and animal feed, including many commercial dog foods. Of course, no humans are made into fertilizer after they're dead. Or not anyway, unless they wish to be. Chapter 11. Out of the fire, into the compost bin. Another new ways to end up. When a cow dies on a visit to the hospital, it does not go to a morgue. It goes to a walk-in refrigerator, such as the one at Colorado State University Veterinary Teaching Hospital in Fort Collins. Like most things in walk-in refrigerators, the bodies here are arranged to maximize space. Against one wall, sheep are stacked like sandbags against a flood. Cows hang from ceiling hooks, affecting the familiar side of beef silhouette. A horse, bisected mid-torso, lies in halves on the floor, a vaudeville costume after the show. The death of a farm animal is death reduced to the physical and the practical, a matter of waste disposal and little more. With no soul to be ushered onward, no mourners to attend to, death's overseers are free to pursue more practical approaches. Is there a more economical way to dispose of the body? A more environmentally friendly way? Could something useful be done with the remains? With our own deaths, the disposal of the body was for centuries incorporated into the ritual of memorial and farewell. Mourners are present at the lowering of the coffin, and until more recently, the measured remote control conveyance of the casket into the cremation furnace. With the majority of cremations now done out of view of the mourners, the memorial has begun to be separated from the process of disposal. Does this free us to explore new possibilities? Kevin McCabe, owner of McCabe Funeral Homes in Farmington Hills, Michigan, is one man who thinks that the answer is yes. One day soon, he plans to do to dead people what Colorado State University is doing to dead sheep and horses. The process, called tissue digestion when you speak to the livestock people and water reduction when you speak to McCabe, was invented by a retired pathology professor named Gordon Kay and a retired professor of biochemistry named Bruce Weber. McCabe is the mortuary consultant for Kay and Weber's company, WR2, Incorporated, based in Indianapolis, Indiana. The mortuary end of corpse disposal had been a low priority over at WR2 until the spring of 2002, when Ray Brant Marsh of Noble, Georgia, dragged the good name of crematory operators everywhere about as far through the mud as a name could go. At last count, some 339 decomposing bodies were found on land surrounding his tri-state crematory, stacked in sheds, dumped in a pond, crammed in a concrete burial vault. Marsh initially claimed the incinerator wasn't working, but it was. Then rumors of decomposing body photos in his computer files made the rounds. It began to look as though Marsh wasn't simply cheap and unethical, but deeply strange. As the body count grew, Gordon Kay began to get calls, half a dozen from funeral directors and one from a New York State assemblyman, all wanting to know how soon the mortuary tissue digester might be available should the public begin to shun crematoriums. At that time, Kay estimated it would be another 6 months. In a few hours, Kay and Weber's equipment can dissolve the tissues of a corpse and reduce it to 2 or 3% of its body weight. What remains is a pile of decollagenated bones that can be crumbled in one's fingers. Everything else has been turned into what the WR2 brochure describes as a sterile, coffee-colored liquid. Tissue digestion relies on two key ingredients, water and an alkali better known as lye. When you put lye into water, you create a pH environment that frees the hydrogen ion of the water to break apart the proteins and fats that make up a living organism. That's why water reduction, though clearly a euphemism, is an apt term. You're using water to break the chemical bonds in the large molecules of the body, says Kay. But Kay does not gloss over the lie. This is a man who has spent 11 years in the world of carcass disposal, or disposition, if you are speaking with McCabe. In effect, it's a pressure cooker with Drano, says Kay of his invention. The lie does more or less what it would do if you swallowed it. You don't digest it. It digests you. What's nice about an alkali, as opposed to an acid, is that in doing the deed, the chemical renders itself inert and can be safely flushed down the drain. There's no question that tissue digestion makes good sense for disposing of dead animals. It destroys pathogens, and more important, it destroys prions, including the ones that cause mad cow disease, which rendering cannot reliably do. It does not pollute as incinerators do. And because no natural gas is used, the process is approximately 10 times cheaper than incineration. What are the advantages for humans? If they're humans who own funeral homes, the advantage is economical. A mortuary digester will be relatively inexpensive to buy, less than $100,000, and, as mentioned, a tenth as expensive to run. Digesters make especially good sense in rural areas, whose populations are too small to keep a crematory furnace continuously active, which is the best way for it to be. Firing it up and letting it cool all the way down and refiring it over and over damages the furnace lining. Ideally, you want to keep the fire going nonstop, turning it down just low enough to remove the ashes and put the next body in, but this presumes a steady lineup of corpses. What are the advantages for humans who don't own funeral homes? Assuming it's going to cost a family more or less the same as cremation would, why would someone choose to have this done? I asked McCabe, a chatty, affable Midwesterner, how he plans to market the process to bereaved families. Simple, he said. To families who come in and say, I want him to be cremated, I'm going to say, no problem. You can cremate him, or you can do our water reduction process. And they're going to say, what's that? And I'm going to go, well, it's like cremation, but we do it with water under pressure instead of fire. And they're going to go, All right, let's do it. And the media is going to go, there's lye in there. You're boiling them in lye. I mean, Kevin, I said, aren't you leaving out a pretty big part of it? Oh, yeah, they're going to know all that, he said. I've talked to people and they have no problem. I'm not sure I believe him on these two points, but I do believe what he said next. Besides, watching somebody cremated is not pretty. I decided I had to see the process for myself. I contacted the chairman of the State Anatomical Board in Gainesville, Florida, where for the past 5 years, digesters have been taking care of anatomy lab leftovers, here under the name Reductive Cremation, in order to hopscotch state regulations that willed bodies be cremated. When I got no reply, Kay gave me a contact at Colorado State, and that is how I came to be standing in a walk-in refrigerator full of dead livestock in Fort Collins, Colorado. The digester sits on a loading dock 15 feet from the walk-in. It is a round stainless steel vat, similar in size and circumference to a California hot tub. Indeed, when full, the two hold approximately the same mass of heated liquid and passive bodies, about 1,700 pounds. Manning the digester this afternoon is a soft-voiced wildlife pathologist named Terry Spratcher. Spratcher wears rubber boots pulled over his pants and latex gloves. Both are streaked with blood, for he has been doing sheep necropsies. Despite what his job duties might suggest, this is a man who loves animals. When he heard I lived in San Francisco, he brightened and said that he enjoyed visiting the city, and the reason he enjoyed it was not the hills or the wharf or the restaurants, but the Marine Mammal Center, an obscure ecology center up the coast where oil-soaked otters and orphaned elephant seals are rehabbed and released. I guess this is how it is with animal careers. If you deal with animals for a living, you generally also deal with their deaths. Above our heads, the unit's perforated liner basket hangs from a ceiling-mounted hydraulic hoist on a track. A taciturn, ginger-haired lab assistant named Wade Clemens pushes a button, and the basket travels across the loading dock to the door of the walk-in, where he is standing. When he's done loading the basket, he and Spratcher will guide it back to the airspace above the digester and lower it in. Just like French fries, says Spratcher quietly. Hanging from the hoist inside the walk-in is a large steel hook. Clemens bends down to couple this to a second hook, anchored on a thick band of muscle at the base of the horse's neck. Clemens presses a button. The half-horse rises. The sight is a disquieting blend of horse as we know it. Placid, dejected horse face. Silken mane and neck where young girls' hands went, and slasher-flick gore. Clemens loads one half, then the other, lowering it down in beside its partner, the two halves fitting neatly together like new shoes in a box. With the seasoned expertise of a grocery bagger, Clemens loads sheep, a calf, and the nameless slippery contents of 2 90-gallon gut buckets from the necropsy lab, until the basket is full. Then he presses a button that sends the basket along the ceiling track on a short, slow trip across the loading dock to the digester. I try to imagine a cluster of mourners standing by, as they have stood by gravesides as winches lower coffins, and in cremation parlors as coffins on conveyor belts are pulled slowly into crematory retorts. Of course, for mortuary digestions, some alterations will be made in the name of dignity. The mortuary model will use a cylindrical basket and will process only one body at a time. McCabe doesn't see this as something the family would stand around and watch, though if they wanted to see the equipment, they'd be welcome. With the basket in place, Spratcher closes the digester's steel hatch and presses a series of buttons on the computerized console. Washing machine noises can be heard as water and chemicals pour into the tank. I return for the raising of the basket the following day. The process normally takes 6 hours for a load this size, but Colorado State needs to upgrade its pipes. Spratcher unbolts the hatch and raises the lid. I don't smell anything, and am emboldened to lean my head over the vat and peer inside. Now I smell something. It is a large, assertive smell, unappetizing and unfamiliar. Gordon Kay refers to the smell as soap-like, leading one to wonder where he buys his toiletries. The basket appears largely empty, which is pretty amazing when you think about what it looked like going in. Clemens turns on the hoist, and the basket rises from the machine. At the bottom is a foot and a half of bone holes. I resolve to take Kay's word for it that you can crumble them in your fingers. Clemens opens a small door near the base of the basket and scrapes the bones out into a dumpster. Though it's no more grisly than the emptying of a crematory retort, it's hard for me to imagine this catching on as part of the American funerary tradition. But here again, the funerary rendition wouldn't go quite like this. Had this been a mortuary digestion, the bone remnants would be dried and either pulverized for scattering or, as McCabe envisions, placed in a bone box, a sort of mini-coffin that could be stored in a crypt or buried. Everything other than bone has liquefied and disappeared down the drain. When I got back home, I asked McCabe how he was going to handle the potentially disturbing realities of the dearly departed molecules ending up in the municipal sewer system. "The public seems okay with it," he said. Contrasting it with cremation, he said, "You're either going to go in the sewer or you're going to go up in the atmosphere." People who are environmentally conscious know that we're better off putting something sterile and pH neutral into the sewer than we are letting mercury, from fillings, go into the air. McCabe is counting on environmental conscience to sell the process. Will it work? We'll soon see. McCabe is poised to take delivery of the world's first mortuary tissue digester sometime in 2003. You only have to look at the story of cremation to appreciate that changing the way America disposes of its dead is a feat not easily accomplished. The best way to do this would be to buy a copy of Stephen Prothero's Purified by Fire, A History of Cremation in America. Prothero is a professor of religion at Boston University, a masterful writer and a respected historian. His book includes a bibliography of more than 200 original and secondary sources. The second best way to do it would be to read the passage that follows, which is basically small chunks of Prothero's book run through the tissue digester of my brain. Ironically, one of the cremationists' earliest and loudest arguments in America was that cremation was less polluting than burial. In the mid-1800s, it was widely and wrongly believed that buried, decomposing bodies gave off noxious gases, which polluted the groundwater and made their way up through the dirt to form deadly, hovering graveyard miasmas that tainted the air and sickened those who wandered past. Cremation was presented as the pure and hygienic alternative, and might well have caught on then, had the first U.S. cremation not proved to be a PR disaster. America's first crematory was built in 1874 on the estate of Francis Julius Lemoyne, a retired physician, abolitionist, and champion of education. Though his credentials as a social reformer were impressive, his beliefs about personal hygiene may have worked against him in his crusade for funereal cleanliness and purity. According to Prothero, he believed that the human body was never intended by its creator to come in contact with water, and as such, traveled about in his own personal miasma. Lemoyne's first customer was one Baron Lapalme, who was to be incinerated in a public ceremony to which national and European press had been invited. Lapalme's reasons for requesting cremation remain murky, but somewhere in the mix was a deep-seated fear of live burial, for he claimed to have met a woman who had been buried alive, presumably not very deeply. As things turned out, Mr. Lapalme was finished some months before the crematory was, and had to be preserved. He fell victim to the spotty and improvisational embalming techniques of the day, and wasn't looking his best when rowdier elements of the crowd, uninvited townsfolk mainly, pulled the sheet from his earthly remains. Crude jokes were made, school children snickered, reporters from newspapers across the country criticized the carnival air of the proceedings and the lack of religious ritual and due solemnity. Cremation was all but doomed to an early grave. Prothero posits that Lemoyne had erred in presenting a more or less secular ceremony. His unsentimental memorial speech, devoid of references to the hereafter and the Almighty, and the bare utilitarian design of his crematory, reporters likened it to a bake oven and a large cigar box, offended the sensibilities of Americans used to Victorian-style funerals with their formal masses and their profusely flowered, ornately appointed caskets. America was not ready for pagan funerals. It would not be until 1963 when the Catholic Church, in the wake of the reforms of Vatican II, relaxed the ban on cremation, that disposal by incineration would start to take hold in a serious way. 1963 was a banner year for cremation. It was that summer that the American Way of Death, the late Jessica Mitford's expose of deceit and greed in the burying business, came out. What has inspired funeral reformers throughout history, Prothero maintains, has been a distaste for pomp and religious pageantry. They may hand out pamphlets detailing the horrors and health risks of the grave, but what really bothered them was the waste and fakery of the traditional Christian funeral, the rococo coffins, the hired mourners, the expense, the wasted land. Freethinkers like Lemoyne envisioned a purer, simpler, back-to-basics approach. Unfortunately, as Prothero points out, these men have tended to take mortuary utilitarianism too far, outraging the churches and alienating the public. Take the American doctor who put forth a plan to boost the dead's utility by skinning them prior to cremation and making leather. Take the Italian professor who advocated burning cadaveric fat in street lamps, speculating that the 250 people who died each day in New York would yield 30,600 pounds of fuel daily. Take the cremationist, Sir Henry Thompson, who sat down and calculated the value in pounds sterling of the 80,000-odd people who died each year in London should their cremated remains be used as fertilizer. It worked out to about 50,000 pounds, though the customers, should any have emerged, would have been dealt a raw deal, as cremains make lousy fertilizer. If you wanted to fertilize your garden with dead people, you were better off doing it the hay way. Dr. George Hay was a Pittsburgh chemist who advocated pulverizing dead bodies so that they would, to quote an 1888 newspaper article on the topic, return to the elements as soon as possible, if for no other purpose than to furnish a fertilizer. Here is Hay, quoted at length in the article, which is pasted into a scrapbook belonging to the historical collection of the Mount Auburn Cemetery in Cambridge, Massachusetts. The machines might be so contrived as to break the bones first in pieces the size of a hen egg, next into fragments of the size of a marble, and the mangled and lacerated mass could next be reduced by means of chopping machines and steam power to mincemeat. At this stage, we have a homogeneous mixture of the entire body structures in the form of a pulpous mass of raw meat and raw bones. This mass should now be dried thoroughly by means of steam heat at a temperature of 250 Fahrenheit. Because firstly, we want to reduce the material to a condition convenient for handling, and secondly, we wish to disinfect it. Once in this condition, it would command a good price for the purpose of manure. Which brings us, ready or not, to the modern human compost movement. Here we must travel to Sweden, to a tiny island called Lerun, due west of Gothenburg. This is the home of a 47-year-old biologist entrepreneur named Suzanne Wee Masak. 2 years ago, Wee Masak found a company called Promessa, which seeks to replace cremation, the choice of 70% of Swedes, with a technologically enhanced form of organic composting. This is no mom-and-pop undertaking of the lunatic green fringe. Wee Masak has King Carl Gustaf and the Church of Sweden on her side. She has crematoria vying to be the first to compost a dead Swede. She has the dead Swede ready to go, a terminally ill man who contacted her after hearing her on the radio. He has since taken up residence in a freezer in Stockholm. She has major corporate backing, an international patent, over 200 press clips. Mortuary professionals and entrepreneurs from Germany, Holland, Israel, Australia, and the United States have expressed interest in representing Promessa's technology in their own countries. She appears to be doing, in a matter of years, what took the cremationists a century. This is especially impressive, given that what she is proposing has its closest precedent in the ideas of Dr. George Hay. Let's say a man dies in Uppsala, and that he has checked the box on the church-distributed living will that says, I want that the new method freeze-drying ecological funeral will be used if it is available when I die. The equipment is still being developed. Wemasak hopes to have it ready sometime in 2003. The man's body will be brought to an establishment that has licensed Promessa's technology. He will be lowered into a vat of liquid nitrogen and frozen. From here, he will progress to the second chamber, where either ultrasound waves or mechanical vibration will be used to break his easily shattered self into small pieces, more or less the size of ground chuck. The pieces, still frozen, will then be freeze-dried and used as compost for a memorial tree or shrub, either in a churchyard memorial park or in the family's yard. The difference between George Hay and Suzanne Wemasak is that Hay, in suggesting that we feed crops with the dead, was simply trying to be practical, to do something beneficial and useful with a dead human body. Wemasak is not a utilitarian. She is an environmentalist. And in parts of Europe, environmentalism is tantamount to its own religion. For this reason, I think, she may just succeed. To understand Wemasak's catechism, it helps to pay a visit to her compost pile. It lies beside the barn on the acre and a half that she and her family rent on Lerun. Wemasak shows her compost pile to guests the way an American homeowner might show off the new entertainment center or the youngest son's grades. It is her pride and, it is no exaggeration to say, her joy. She pushes a shovel into the heap and raises a loamy clod. It is complex and full of unnameable fragments, like a lasagna baked by an unsupervised child. She points out feathers from a duck that died a few weeks back, shells from the mussels that her husband, Peter, farms on the other side of the island, cabbage from last week's coleslaw. She explains the difference between rotting and composting, that the needs of humans and the needs of compost are similar. Oxygen, water, air temperature that does not stray far from 37 degrees centigrade. Her point, we are all nature, all made of the same basic materials, with the same basic needs. We are no different on a very basic level from the ducks and the mussels and last week's coleslaw. Thus, we should respect nature, and when we die, we should give ourselves back to the earth. As though sensing that she and I might not be entirely on the same page, perhaps not even in the same general vicinity of the Dewey Decimal System, Wemasak asks me if I compost. I explain that I don't have a garden. Ah, okay. She considers this fact. I get the feeling that to Wemasak, this is not so much an explanation as a criminal confession. I'm feeling more like last week's coleslaw than usual. She returns to the clod. Compost should not be ugly, she is saying. It should be lovely. It should be romantic. She feels similarly about dead bodies. Death is a possibility for new life. The body becomes something else. I would like that something else be as positive as possible. People have criticized her, she says, for lowering the dead to the level of garden waste. She doesn't see it that way. I say, let's lift garden waste to as high a level as human bodies. What she's trying to say is that nothing organic should be treated as waste. It should all be recycled. I am waiting for Wemasak to put down the shovel, but now it is coming closer. Smell it, she offers. I would not go so far as to say that her compost smells romantic, but it does not smell like rotting garbage. Compared to some of the things I've been smelling these days,